friends, we can all listen to the Sunny Side of Sports.
Great show, bro. This is Sunny Side of Sports.
Right here on the Voice of America.
Voice of America.
Sporty greetings to all our Voice of America listeners. This is VOA Sunny Young in Washington. Welcome to the March 25th edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. And let's give a Sunny Side of Sports salute to the men's national football teams from Guinea and Burkina Faso, which have officially booked their tickets to the 2022 Africa Cup of Nations tournament in Cameroon. In Conakry Wednesday, Guinea defeated visiting Mali 1-0 on a 75th-minute goal by Seduba Suma. The victory sealed Guinea's place at the Nations Cup from Group A with 11 points. Top of the table, Mali, with 13 points, already had qualified for African football's premier event. In Group B, Burkina Faso advanced to the Nations Cup after a scoreless draw with host Uganda. Burkina Faso's 9 points in the group is one ahead of Uganda and two more than Malawi, which beat South Sudan on Wednesday 1-0. Richard Mbulu had the goal for Malawi. In Group C, Sudan scored a 2-0 road victory against Sao Tome. Now, this is a very tight group. The Sudanese now have 9 points, the same as Ghana and South Africa, who are playing each other today, Thursday. In Group F, Rwanda scored its first victory in the qualifying competition, beating visiting Mozambique 1-0. Biren Giro had the goal for Rwanda, which now has 5 points in the group. Cameroon tops the table with 10 points. The indomitable Lions of Cameroon qualified automatically for the Nations Cup as the host country. Now, the indomitable Lions will be back in action Friday in a road qualifier against Cape Verde, which currently has 4 points, the same total as Mozambique. So, Rwanda, Cape Verde, and Mozambique in a tight battle for that last qualifying place from Group F. In Group L Wednesday, Ethiopia took a big step towards Nations Cup qualification with a big 4-0 victory against visiting Madagascar. The Ethiopians now top the table with 9 points, followed by Ivory Coast and Madagascar with 7 points each, and Niger with 3 points. Ivory Coast plays Niger on Friday as the Africa Cup of Nations qualifying competition continues.
You're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
The African Tour Golf Foundation says it's beginning new training programs for primary and secondary school students in Nigeria. To find out more, Iron Mike Mbonye spoke with the foundation's president, Harris Okada.
African Tour Golf Foundation is embarking on school training program here in Owerri, Imo State. Like I said in my last interview, we have done that in Abuja before, and now we're embarking to do that in Owerri. We started here for a while, and we are getting on a day-by-day basis more schools. We realize that golf development can only get better by taking it down to the grassroots, and that's why we're here in Owerri. We've started with grade one, grade two, primary, secondary schools here in Owerri. We're teaching golf to them on a daily basis. And I can tell you, it's gradually getting results. Most of these children are so enthusiastic about it, and they don't fail to come for their classes as of when. We take summer schools in different days. Some schools are Monday, some others are Tuesday, some others are Wednesday. And we do like this on a daily basis, Monday to Friday. And we believe strongly that if we continue at this pace, in a couple of years to come, we're going to get sound young children who are going to embrace this game and play it as professionals.
Are there instances of the benefits of this program? And what will the students stand to gain?
As of talking about instances of benefit of this program is huge. You know, golf, like I emphasize every time I go to the school program, I said there are core values of golf. And those core values are very, very huge to teach to the younger generation of children today. Honesty, integrity, sportsmanship, being a good friend, trying to, morals goes with golf, because golf players are people with integrity. A lot of these children stand to benefit so much from this program because it helps to form them, their personality for their future development. And golf being a sport, it's just not ordinarily recreational sports. It's equally a sport where people make money. All over the world today, in Europe and America, younger teenagers are embracing golf and making a lot of money in it. It's just an instance of what is happening in European Tour and the USPGA Tour. If you look at top players in the world now, they are in their 20s. These guys all started playing golf as early as 5, 6, 7, and 8 years. And today, they are something else on the golf course. So the benefit of this program is enormous, going with time. And we believe strongly that if we get it right, as we're doing it, the children are going to blossom and become professionals in the future.
What has been the response of sponsors and golf lovers to your programs aimed at developing the game in Nigeria?
Talking about sponsorship, sponsorship in golf in this part of the world is zero. You hardly see people trying to sponsor golf because they believe it's an elite game. They don't see what we see. They don't see the opportunities that are there for the younger generation in the future. But again, I was excited to see a young man who I regularly play golf here, who runs has a hotel chain here, Protea Hotel in Owerri here, by the name of Chekezie Dozier. He has taken it by himself on every program of golf development we have to bring snacks and food for these children. He cannot, in fact, I shed tears the first day I saw him bring this food, and I said, for who? He said, it's for these children. And he appreciated what we are doing. And there's equally a couple of people who just give us a pat at the back and say, great job you are doing. For us, we just want to give a selfless service. It's not about anything. For us, we want these children to become like, they don't want to come out of school and say they are looking for a job, because there's no job opportunities in this part of the world right now. Nobody's creating, government is actually not creating as much job as possible. So we have to, as much as possible, try to give them this opportunity so that, because once they get this as a career for themselves, they don't need to start looking for job and the other. And there's equally a platform for them to excel. Like as we're doing a tournament in Owerri here now, they are seeing the ones who are playing tournament and making money. Christopher Amber is almost at the verge of winning the third leg of the African Tour Road to Nigerian Masters. So we believe strongly that these children are watching them and they are trying to embrace the same track as they did. And bearing in mind that Christopher went to South Africa, we sent him on training in 2012, and that's why he's as good as he is now. The best Nigerian golfer for you to know is Andrew Odo. He just finished in Kenya, a magical Kenyan Open, and he didn't make cut. Not because he's not a good player, he's a fine player, but again, it's all lack of sponsorship, lack of starting golf earlier in life, and we believe that with the track we're going right now, it will be a different story in a couple of years to come. Thank you for this opportunity, and God bless you.
That's Harris Okada, the president of the African Tour Golf Foundation, and he spoke with Iron Mike Mbonye on the telephone from Owerri, Nigeria.
Sporty greetings. This is Harris Okada, president of African Tour Golf Foundation. You are listening to Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
The World Health Organization and U.S. Centers for Disease Control say coughing and sneezing can spread COVID-19. Physical distancing, staying at least 1 meter away from people outside your family, can protect everyone. For more information, check with reliable sources such as the WHO and Africa CDC. And remember to listen to VOA for the latest on COVID-19.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hi, I'm Helen Maroulis, Olympic champion for Team USA, and you're listening to The Sunny Side of Sports on The Voice of America.
Voice of America!
In Olympic news, the torch relay for the postponed Tokyo Games began its journey across Japan on Thursday. It's a 121-day odyssey that will end in the capital at the opening ceremony for the Olympics on July 23rd. The relay began in northeastern Fukushima Prefecture, the area that was devastated by the 2011 earthquake, tsunami, and the meltdown of three nuclear reactors. About 18,000 people died in the catastrophe. The first runner with the torch was Azusa Iwashimizu, a key player on the Japanese team that lifted the Women's World Cup trophy in 2011. Wearing a white tracksuit, she carried the torch out of the J Village Indoor Soccer Training Center. She was surrounded by 14 other members of the World Cup winning team, with coach Norio Sasaki at the rear. All wore white tracksuits. The ceremony was closed to the public because of the fear of spreading the coronavirus, but was streamed live online. Seiko Hashimoto, the president of the Tokyo Local Organizing Committee, said, and I quote, "The torch of Tokyo 2020 will become a bright light for hope for Japanese citizens and citizens in the world, and a light at the end of the tunnel." Fans are being told to maintain social distance along the road as the torch passes and to refrain from loud cheering. Olympic organizers have said they will stop or reroute the torch relay if crowding becomes a problem during the four-month journey. As we follow the torch to the Tokyo Olympic Stadium on July 23rd, I'm sure there will be some bright lights in terms of athletics at the Games. This evening, the energetic Andy Edwards reflects on the 30th anniversary of another bright light athletic moment in Tokyo, the World Championship long jump showdown between Americans Mike Powell and Carl Lewis.
In 40 years of covering athletics as a journalist, I've had three work trips to Japan. Firstly, to the pre-Olympic holding camp in Chiba, near Tokyo, for the British and American teams before the 1988 Games in Seoul. And then the World Championships in Tokyo, 1991. And lastly, the 2007 World Championships in Osaka. Each trip has made a lasting imprint on my mind, not only for the competition, but because Japan feels quite unlike anywhere else my work has taken me, and that includes other countries in Asia. Yes, you can eat rice and noodles elsewhere, but nothing feels quite like Japan. Attention to detail and meticulous planning were the hallmarks of the organisers of the championships, setting a standard which was amply matched by the competition, and for me, above all, the men's long jump final. Here's some background. Carl Lewis went into the final as the reigning world champion. He was the king of track and field in terms of men's sprints and long jump, had won four golds at the Los Angeles Olympics in 1984, emulating the achievement of his fellow American Jesse Owens at the Berlin Games in 1936. He repeated that feat in Seoul 4 years after Los Angeles, notably after the first man across the line in the 100 metres final, Ben Johnson of Canada, had tested positive for drugs. Before Tokyo in 1991, he had won 65 consecutive long jump finals, and his last defeat was 10 years previously. He radiated star quality, and he knew it, but given his achievements, he was entitled to do so. By that time, his chief rival for the long jump was his fellow American Mike Powell. Well, rival, yes, but in their previous 14 encounters, Powell had lost to Lewis in every one, including the Olympic final in Seoul, when he finished second. When Carl Lewis was a teenage star, Mike Powell had barely begun his career as a long jumper, and that was his specialist event, rather than being a great sprinter like Lewis. Here's a personal note. Once I had adapted to different time zones, the heat and humidity of Tokyo in August, covering these championships was among the best work experiences I've ever had. After each morning session, I would send my radio reports, then hurry out of the stadium, catch the metro for the short distance to my hotel, then into running kit and run up and down some side street for about 20 minutes. I needed that break in what were always long working days. Still dripping from the shower, I would be back in regular clothes and cross to the Sendagaya metro station for a dish of the greatest fast food I've ever had. My favourite was onion noodles, eaten standing up in a small, crowded booth. 10 minutes or so on the metro and I was back in the Olympic Park and ready to prepare for the afternoon session, which would end late at night. For all that I mentioned heat and humidity, the temperature dropped by mid-evening to be just about ideal for sprints and field events. Cue then the long jump final. Carl Lewis began well, clearing 8 metres 68 in round one, while Mike Powell was well short of 8 metres. It looked as if King Carl was about to ascend the throne once again, especially when he jumped further than Bob Beamon's world record distance of 8 metres 90 set in the Mexico Olympics 23 years before. But Lewis's mark of 8 metres 91 in round three had a following wind stronger than the legal limit, so it did not count as a world record. Halfway through the final of six rounds, Mike Powell had found his rhythm, landing a solid 8 metres 54. In round four, he had a big jump, threatening Lewis's lead, but it was invalid because he was judged to have put a toe over the line on the jump board. That left him with two more chances. Well, he used the next supremely well. He went far, far into the long jump pit, knew it was a big distance, and when the world record of 8 metres 95 came up with the following wind inside the legal limit, Powell charged around the infield, shouting to his coach sitting in the stands, Randy Huntington, "It's mine!" Indeed it was. Well, though Carl Lewis jumped in his remaining efforts, Mike Powell had the world record as well as the world title. He retained that world long jump title in Stuttgart in 1993. Carl Lewis went on to win a fourth Olympic long jump gold in Atlanta in 96. These days, the online world means you can watch their contest over and over again, not least to admire the Japanese television coverage, which captures their faces in critical moments. It's a story of timeless drama. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Andy Edwards in London.
I'm Kendra Harrison. I'm the 100 hurdle world record holder for Team USA, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
Hi, this is Tatiana McFadden, 17-time Paralympic medalist, 7-time gold medalist, 17-time marathon champion, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on Voice of America.
In Ghana, Anatu Sadat is making headlines for wearing a hijab in her very first Ghana Women's Premier League football match. In this encore Sunny Side of Sports presentation, Yawafusu Larbi tells us more from Accra. Sporty greetings, Yao!
Sporty greetings, Sunny. Now, forced to choose between your faith and your career is a hurdle no one wants to go through. But that was the situation of Muslim footballers before FIFA lifted the ban on hijabs in 2014. It all started in 2007 when Canadian footballer Asmahan Mansour attempted to wear a headscarf to play but was not permitted by the referee. Years on, the Canadian story is the base of a subject important and central to women's participation in sports. In her very first Ghana Women's Premier League game for the Northern Ladies, Anatu Sadat went viral for her looks, something she found perplexing.
In the beginning of the season, I didn't wear it because it wasn't available back then. And the comments came in from around the whole world, like Ghana. A lot of people were commenting, talking about how beautiful I am, forgetting, mentioning how I even performed during the game. I was happy, but in a way, I wasn't that happy.
Few weeks later, she was in the spotlight again, but for a totally different reason. She had given Ghanaians a rare sight of a footballer wearing a hijab on the pitch, and that was something she had always wanted to do, although she had fear pulling her back.
I was actually scared. There was this fear in me because, you know, I've never seen someone using it in Ghana here. But I knew FIFA had banned the using of the hijab some years back, but actually in the year 2014 they amended it. So whilst I was going to use it, I had something pulling it back, but because like I just had to do it. It is something that I always wanted to do, so I just put all those aside and I used it.
She's the beneficiary of a humanitarian project which aims at providing apparel for Muslim footballers who are willing to honor their faith whilst playing football.
I'm a Muslim, so it's a custom in the Islamic society for a lady to have the yatoiba on, because it's part of the beliefs of Islam. So I'm proud and I've always wanted to do that. So when I got the opportunity, I just grabbed it.
Sumani Basirudin is a coach of Northern Ladies Football Club, and he talks on how it will change the lives of many Muslim footballers.
And she being the first lady to use it, I was very happy, especially coming from my team. I think this would go a long way to touch other clubs and other Muslim girls who are into football. And this would also give a way to Muslim girls and parents who are denying their wives to do it, but take in playing football and then take it as a career and then use it as something that can bring food on the table in future.
For the Northern Ladies striker, she hopes her story will inspire other Muslim footballers. When writing the history of religion in the place of Ghana football, there's a name that can't be forgotten, the name of a woman who chose both faith and football. Her name is Anatu Sadat. For the Sunny Side of Sports, this is Yao Fusilabi in Accra.
This is the Voice of America. Washington, D.C.
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the Sunny Side of Sports on the Voice of America. American football champion Tom Brady and world champion race car driver Lewis Hamilton recently teamed up for a late-night interview and compared notes on the key to their success. VOA's Gwen Ooten shares their secrets in this report. Sporty greetings, Gwen.
Sporty greetings, Sonny. Very often, people who want to know how to be successful are told to follow the advice of successful people. In the sports world, it would be hard to find a duo more worthy of that distinction than reigning F1 champion Lewis Hamilton and NFL Super Bowl champ Tom Brady. And during a recent online chat with late-night TV host James Corden, the two men shared their secrets for success. Last season, British driver Lewis Hamilton made history by winning his seventh F1 World Championship title, and the 36-year-old said his road to success all comes down to passion.
It's the love for what you do, and you know, I know that I can drive a car, but there's all these other things. And as you get older also and more experienced, and that early journey is kind of, it's about your mission, and then very, very much kind of your sole kind of goal. But then when you get for me, when I've got further along, realize I'm a part of a huge team of over 1,000 people. How can you elevate? How can you lift other people? And actually seeing other people succeed is even, it's almost more rewarding than seeing yourself succeed.
Last month, quarterback Tom Brady reached an achievement equal to Hamilton's when he clinched his 7th record-extending Super Bowl win. The 43-year-old said he agrees with Hamilton that one of the keys to success is watching others succeed. But the 5-time MVP added success also means striving to be the best version of himself.
I think the love of what I'm doing and then the willingness to continue to learn and to improve is what is really the most enjoyable. Not only that, having teammates where I can watch them grow, learn, improve. Ultimately, I was always trying to be my best, not the best. And being my best was really important to me because I never felt like I should compare myself to anyone, not because I looked up to so many other great athletes. But at the end of the day, I always got satisfaction knowing that I prepared as hard as I could. I gave, you know, so much emotionally to what I was doing, I gave so much to my teammates. I gave everything I had.
The two stars were asked how successful they thought they would be in each other's sport. Lewis Hamilton seemed reluctant to picture himself on the football field.
I would run the opposite way. Seeing those guys, the size that they are, I don't know if I could do it. That's what, for me, it's easier being at 200 miles an hour for me.
On the other hand, Tom Brady thought he would do pretty well in F1 racing if only the helmets were bigger.
I always thought I was a pretty good driver. I said in the mail this week, I got the most beautiful gift. And you know what I realized? It doesn't fit. So how can I be a driver? How can I be a driver when the helmets don't fit me?
The two champions said they've admired each other's achievements over the course of their stellar careers. Brady said he knew early on that Lewis Hamilton would become one of the giants in his sport.
I mean, Lewis was, from the time he was a teenager, you know, one of the, you know, real prodigies of the sport. And what I think there's a lot of pressure when you're that young, you know, and then, hey, you're going to be this and you're going to, become one of the greats in this particular sport, which takes so much discipline, so much determination. And I think knowing Lewis over a period of time, it's not like, hey, he just shows up to the race and hops in the car and then goes in and does his thing, wins the race like he has so many times. It's a year-round process for him.
And Hamilton says he consistently takes notes on NFL star Tom Brady.
I've been reading about some of the things that Tom does in his training, how he prepares himself, how he conducts himself with his team. There are so many things that you can take from watching a great athlete like Tom that you can then apply to being a better athlete yourself. So I'm trying to learn from the great. And sometimes I message him, trying to like secretly get a bit of advice.
Sports icons Lewis Hamilton and Tom Brady proving that no matter how successful you are, you can always learn more from the greats. And that is all from me, Sonny. Back over to you.
Thanks, Gwen. That's my VOA colleague, Gwen Uten. And speaking of greats, let's give a Sunny Side of Sports birthday salute to boxing great Vladimir Klitschko, who is celebrating his 45th birthday on this Thursday. While Vladimir lost the last two fights of his prize-fighting career to Tyson Fury and Anthony Joshua, he's considered to be one of the best heavyweight champions of all time. Vladimir Klitschko represented Ukraine at the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta, where he won the gold medal in the super heavyweight division. From 2004 to 2015, Vladimir and his brother Vitaly dominated the heavyweight ranks in professional boxing, a period that's become known as the Klitschko era. Happy 45th birthday, Vladimir Klitschko. And that wraps up the March 25th edition of the show. Thank you for tuning in. I'm VOA's Sonny Young in Washington. And that's the sunny side of sports.